Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of New Books in Critical Theory, a channel that's part of the New Books Network. I'm really pleased to be joined this evening by Alberto Toscano. He'll be giving us some insight into his new book, Late Fascism, Race, Capitalism, and the Politics of Crisis, which was recently released with Verso Books. Alberto is Limited Term Research Associate Professor at the School of Communication at Simon Fraser University, as well as Professor of Critical Theory at the Department of Sociology at Goldsmiths, where he co-directs the Center for Philosophy and Critical Thought. Alberto, welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So first things first, I'll just kind of note that I really enjoyed the book. And like many of our listeners, I'm sure, I wasn't quite sure what to expect before picking it up. I think, you know, kind of discourse about fascism often gets locked into quite circuitous patterns of, you know, arguing about whether or not some specific event or policy decision is or isn't kind of fascistic behavior, rather than considering why certain far-right tendencies are kind of gaining traction as social and economic crises kind of multiply. So your book emphasizes that kind of, you know, while discourse surrounding fascism and its characteristics has proliferated in recent years, for fairly obvious reasons, it seems to reach this kind of impasse between overly heuristic or kind of reductive comparisons with fascisms of the 1930s and 40s and kind of disavows of extant fascistic tendencies. So, you know, lines of argument that use the fact we're not living in this totalitarian state as evidence against fascism's influence in contemporary society. So, yeah, I think your book makes a really kind of generative intervention into these discussions by kind of dislodging the tendency to think analogically and looking instead at the history of capitalist development via, for example, the Black radical tradition and theories of racial capitalism to consider, you know, the dynamic processes that animate fascisms across different contexts. So just to start, could you kind of expand on this a little? Tell us why you wrote the book and what you kind of believe current discourses surrounding fascism or perhaps, you know, incipient forms of fascism overlooking or kind of maybe mis-theorizing.
Well, thank you very much, Louise, and I'm glad the book got, at least from your summary, some of the response that I was hoping for. And I think you're very right that the intention of the book was, as you put it, to dislodge the debate on fascism from some comfortable, at times cliched and circuitous, as you said, patterns. In particular, I wanted to suspend or evade the tendency to limit the debate on fascism to the question of definition and identification. Definition in the sense of debates as to what the typology, classification, or what some people call the kind of fascist minimum, you know, a kind of basic or generic definition of fascism might be. And in terms of identification, I suppose I also wanted to suspend the overwhelming concern of the contemporary debate, at least in a North American or North Atlantic context, with questions such as, not such as, because this is basically the question that gets asked over and over, you know, is Trump a fascist or is he not a fascist? And that seemed to me to be a singularly limiting way of approaching the question, and one that really did not draw on the remarkable wealth of debate, analysis, physiognomy, explanation of both interwar fascisms and similar or related phenomena across the globe in the post-war period. So the book was in that sense born both out of dissatisfaction and recognition of that rich and diverse tradition of debate on fascism, which I thought it was worth recovering, foregrounding, and elaborating upon in order to have a richer conceptual and analytical language with which to approach fascism, not just as a spectacle or a regime, but as something more like a process, a potential, and a dynamic, which is, you know, open to all sorts of repetitions and variations and so on. And so hopefully I've at least presented the reader with some of the materials and some of the methods, let's say, that might allow one to get past the frame of analogy, the frame of asking, you know, is this moment that we live in, or is this figure that we're obsessed with, or is this incipient regime like Nazi Germany or fascist Italy or not, right? And and I think if I've helped, and you know, lots of people are working in this area as well, obviously, but if I've helped to dislodge, as you say, that discourse, then I'm pretty happy.
Great, yeah. And you certainly have. So I think where to start? One of the first elements of the book that we can maybe dig down into is kind of the notion of freedom and the mainstream or kind of superficial view of fascism as the enemy of freedom, you know, in its most familiar totalitarian kind of guises. So as you know, in the book, like a lot of today's far right ideologues, Trump, actually kind of use freedom as their rallying cry. Like freedom from COVID-19 restrictions, or freedom from the woke mob, or freedom from environmental policies, et cetera, et cetera. So could you just speak a little about how your book kind of makes sense of this kind of disconnect?
So the focusing on the scandalous and I suppose to some paradoxical proposition that there are fascist visions of freedom and images of freedom and desires for freedom was aimed in part at undermining the identification of fascism with a Cold War model of totalitarianism, of a kind of monolithic Moloch state that undermines all liberties and, you know, crushes all initiative. This is not to gainsay or deny that that describes rather accurately, you know, much of the grim history of historical fascisms. But I think it doesn't do justice or doesn't enlighten us as to their initial and abiding attraction for large swathes of the population across different class divides and strata. And it makes it very difficult to discern how fascist processes or potentials or energies have mutated in periods and indeed in polities like that of the United States, where freedom is, a dominant signifier, let's say, and a kind of obvious desideratum for all political positions, right? So to really think about the forms of authoritarianism and reaction that are specific to a period sometimes referred to as neoliberal, and that are specific to a moment which is not that of the all-consuming, all-controlling state. I think it was important also to go back and see how, even in the 1920s and 30s, different conceptions of freedom had been generated within fascist and far-right movements themselves. Freedom to dominate, freedom for some against and over others, but also in a more prosaic sense, and I suppose that's the concern of some of the parts of the book where I briefly discuss the early fortunes of Italian fascism and its rise. Also very straightforward liberal economic conceptions of freedom that certainly in the emergence of Italian fascism in the early 1920s were explicitly advanced by that political movement as its economic thinking and its economic policy, right? So that the, mythic nationalist violence and the whole, pageantry of reaction that went with it was explicitly mobilized for the sake of imposing and defending economic liberalism, right? Or what indeed Mussolini called the Manchester state, with reference to 18th and 19th century political economy. So that was part of the reason, and I suppose the other reason to focus on the question of freedom, partly because the book is also a response to North American or North Atlantic debates, was to make the link, which is significant also to the discussion of racial fascism, between fascism and various strands of settler colonial history and settler colonial ideology, where the subjectivity, the position of the petty sovereign, the delegate of state violence, is very crucial, as is their conception of their own freedom. Again, their freedom to subjugate, dispossess, and so on and so forth. And that seemed to me to be formative also of a kind of subjectivity or psychology even of fascism, and that to ignore it is to limit our analysis and our resistance to fascism to a kind of caricature, a caricature of this seamless, fully vertically and horizontally integrated totalitarian machine. And that seemed to me to be a sort of useless image, in a sense, with which to work.
Yeah, so I'd just like to hone in a little bit on kind of the links between kind of neoliberalism there, like, so, because it kind of folds into debates about like the nature and survivability of neoliberalism today, given how neoliberalism is kind of supported by certain promises of individual freedom. And I'm just kind of interested, I've seen lots of proclamations about like the death of neoliberalism, especially over the past few years, mounting crises, kind of many of which conceptualize the rise of like authoritarian figures as reactions to capitalism's breakdown, rather than like heightened versions of kind of tendencies that are imminent within capitalism. So yeah, I just wonder, do these, you know, morbid symptoms that we're witnessing really kind of signal the death of neoliberalism, or do they kind of reflect its attempt to kind of retain its hegemonic integrity, I suppose?
Yeah, that's a really great question, but it's also a really tricky or thorny one. Yeah. I think the first thing to note is that what to me was one of the phases of most interesting and rich and instructive debate on the returns or repetitions of fascism in the post-war period, the 1970s, and this not just in the United States and Europe, but especially in Latin America, was an extremely rich period for debate on the applicability of fascism to conditions very different to those of the interwar period. And so a whole wide gamut of thinkers and militants and scholar activists recovered and transformed the discourse on fascism precisely to analyze and respond to, for instance, the emergence of the military dictatorships in Latin America in the late 60s and early 70s, Brazil, Uruguay, Chile, Argentina. This was not just the purview of Marxist thinkers, though there's an extremely rich debate with all sorts of different positions taken on whether fascism is a term to be used for those regimes that takes place amongst Latin American Marxists in the 70s, which I've tried to write about actually after I finished the book in an article that should be coming out soon in South Atlantic Quarterly. But this is also something that became a matter of fairly mainstream debate. The economist Paul Samuelson, for instance, included discussions of what he called capitalist fascism or market fascism in even his textbook on economics that had been printed and reprinted since the late 1940s, and took Chile as an emblem of what a return to fascism would look like. What he also called, in a formulation that I think is very significant and kind of very illuminating, imposed capitalism, right? So this notion that at a certain pass in the world economy, the persistence and the survival of capitalism, you know, might require this kind of political fix, right? A very different political fix than the one that emerged in the 1920s and 30s in the context of a mass working class movement, the consequences of the Bolshevik Revolution, desires for full employment, war economies, etc., right? So this would be this market fascism, a fascism very much for, so to speak, neoliberal times, right? And even 10 years before that, the Polish economist Michael Kalecki, in an article called The Fascism for Our Times, had, you know, in response to both the pro-Algerian far right in France, but also the Goldwater campaign in the US, had talked about this. You know, the new fascism is not a fascism aimed at a kind of strong welfare state that captures the idea of a worker state from the left and turns it to racial ends, but rather it has this kind of laissez-faire or market-oriented vision. So now, if we turn to the present, I think the claims about the death or demise of neoliberalism are, you know, massively premature, to say the least. I think a certain modality of it, a certain figure, a certain optimistic, pseudo-progressive version of neoliberalism is, of course, you know, if not, you know, mortally wounded, at least hardly in a kind of healthy state. But in terms of the actual political projects and practices of authoritarian and far-right movements across the globe, and especially in terms of the interests and fractions of capital that are supporting them to the hilt, it would be very difficult to see this as in any way a correction or response or overcoming, right, of the terms of kind of, you know, market supremacy and rollback of anything public and social that we've come to recognize as part of neoliberalism. Now, what is significant is, of course, the fortune, the propagandistic effects of a kind of pseudo resistance to market imperatives and market fundamentalism, which of course takes very familiar, disturbingly and depressingly familiar forms in anti-Semitic conspiracies about globalists, in accounts of the alliances of supposed metropolitan elites, with the wretched of the earth or what have you, right? So that's definitely part of the palette of a increasingly integrated international far right, from Orban to Trump, etc. It are these visions of nationalized economies, for the sake of a white majority, or if not white majority, an ethnic or religious majority, imagined majority population, like in the Indian case and what have you. But these are in no way aimed at changing or affecting the rules of the game, except for certain protectionist or restrictive gestures that I think are entirely, compatible, with the furtherance of most aspects of neoliberalism, right? So it's not like extremely violent and regressive and racially coded policies of, restriction of movement of people or workers or migrants or refugees are incompatible with neoliberalism, right? That would be a very dubious proposition, right? So I think in that sense, we can still think of the contemporary reactionary cycle or neo-authoritarian moment, or indeed late fascism, as something which is by no means counter to neoliberalism, but in many ways a mutation of its political terms, right? Or of its political parameters. And in that sense, I draw on it briefly in the book, and I've reviewed their work elsewhere. I do think, while I'm not in agreement with their entire theoretical output, so to speak, but I think that Pierre Delbleu's and Christian Laval's recent work on neoliberalism as civil war actually is quite compelling to see those continuities, right? See those continuities from that 70s moment that even as mainstream a figure as Paul Samuelson saw as the potential emergence of a market fascism to now. And I think especially if we think of the massive forces and interests arrayed behind figures like Trump or Bolsonaro or Orban or Modi, and their integration into whole network of foundations and businesses and multi-millionaires and billionaires, etc. The very idea, right? These are movements that are aimed at interrupting the dominion of profit and plunder is suspect, to say the least, right? Of course, they might lean towards more, gangsteristic or more racket-like forms, but again, it's not like there's anything incompatible between between that and what we've come to call neoliberalism, right? Unless we are treating neoliberalism in this streamlined, sanitized version, right? Now, instead, if we, that's why I think thinking of the 70s conjuncture in Latin America in particular, but of course, we can also think of the relationship between neoliberalism and authoritarianism in, Africa or Southeast Asia or elsewhere. I think if we think of the violence required to impose capitalism under conditions of social conflict and inequality, then I think we see a lot more continuities than discontinuities, and we can develop a healthy skepticism towards the idea of a death of neoliberalism. Now, we might want to speak of a death of the kind of neoliberalism that, or at least a weakening of the kind of neoliberalism that we knew in its buoyant, optimistic phase of Blair and Clinton and the 90s WTO or what have you, right? But that doesn't mean that we've sort of exited that frame.
Great, thank you. Very comprehensive. And I think maybe now is a good kind of moment to look a bit deeper into what you were talking about with racial capitalism earlier. And the kind of explicatory potential of the Black radical tradition when it comes to kind of making sense of fascism within the broad history of capitalism, which I suppose is kind of always really racial capitalism. So could you tell us a little bit more about kind of your rationale behind homing in on figures like Du Bois, Cedric Robinson, Angela Davis, for thinking through late fascism and why, as you note in the book, the prism of race can, I'm going to quote you here, help us to interrogate and displace the normative conviction regarding the absolute antithesis between fascist despotism and liberal democracy.
Yes, so I suppose there's two principal dimensions across which I think the contribution of Black radical theorists to the debate on fascism is vital. One has to do with both a temporal and a geographic expansion of the frame through which we think of fascism as a process and a potential. And this is very evident in George Padmore's discussion of colonial fascism, later picked up by Walter Rodney. It's obviously very critical to the ways in which W.E.B. Du Bois maps out the not just the fascistic dimensions of the counter-revolution of property in the wake of the US Civil War, the general strike of the enslaved, radical reconstruction, but also the way in which he sees that process as then formative in often disavowed ways of the structure of imperialism of the color line, more globally speaking, in the 20th century. And therefore, given the obvious genetic link between imperialism and fascism, also of fascism as we know it, let's say, in the 1920s and 30s, as this phenomenon emerging in latecomers, right, to the colonial or imperial game, right, in Italy and Germany, and formulated in explicitly racial terms, but also certainly in the case of Germany, with explicit reference to the United States and its politics of dispossession, genocide, and frontier dispossession, as a model, right? So that thinking of fascism in a kind of long durée or of fascism before fascism or of the elements and origins of fascism prior to its emergence, which of course is something that we can also find in a different guise in something like Hannah Arendt's discussion of imperialism and her origins of totalitarianism, though in more limited ways. I think that seems to me very important to have better understanding of what the potentials for fascism are in our own moment and where they come from, right? Especially when it comes to having discussions of obviously about fascism in non-European contexts, right? And the second dimension, which is already prominent in the discussion of colonial fascism, but then becomes really crucial in, amongst other things, the exchange between George Jackson and Angela Davis in the late 60s, early 70s, is the question of perspective, the question of differential experiences. I think I put it in the book of fascism, the idea that societies that present themselves and that are imagined and lived as liberal may and do engage in forms of domination and oppression and racial terror that are continuous with and generative of fascism, except that they are, at least, you know, for the time being, only meted out against, you know, certain racialized sectors of a given population, right? And so that what is lived as liberalism by some may be lived by as fascism by others, right? And of course, the history, the exclusive and restrictive and discriminatory history of, you know, liberalism in its colonial and settler colonial context, and in its massive propertied and class dimensions in 19th and early 20th century Europe as well, speaks to that, right? To that discriminatory kind of dimension. So those two aspects together, I think, are really important, again, to dislodge or unsettle a cartoonish juxtaposition between a fascism presented in the guise of the most, you know, genocidal freedom removing form of totalitarianism, and on the other hand, a liberalism presented in a sort of, you know, sanitized fantasy version, right? And so you know, as if we're in this kind of sort of Saving Private Ryan version of history, right? Like this sort of, yeah, the United States, you know, as the paladin of liberalism, World War II as carried out in order to end the Holocaust, which of course it wasn't, and et cetera, et cetera. And on the other hand, a fascism that had no links, right, to liberalism or capitalism or settler colonialism, et cetera, right? And so I think that perspective that comes from the Black radical tradition as both theory and practice, for instance, the practice of anti-fascist solidarity that developed in the response to the Italian invasion of Ethiopia in the 30s, or indeed the Black liberation and abolitionist practices that came to the fore in the late 60s and early 70s. I think that's really critical for me, and I think was really the reason, one of the main energies or motivations behind writing the book was to try and bring that forward into the broader debate and make a strong argument for its centrality.
Mm-hmm. I have a question kind of about how you approached materials, I suppose, in terms of, you know, the broad kind of body of psychological and psychoanalytical oriented theorizations of fascism in the book, and which of these kind of ideas might helpfully supplement, you know, Du Bois's idea of fascism as the counter-revolution of property, and whether there are any that are kind of, that might actually kind of distract us from the ultimate inseparability of capitalism and fascism. Sorry, that's a really general question, I just realized, but yeah.
Well, I mean, I suppose, you know, Du Bois was, after all, the one who used the formulation of psychological wages, right? So I guess you can very much draw a, if not a psychoanalytic, then at least a lot of psychological insight into the subjective constitution of a kind of racial fascist and settler position,
right,
from even Black Reconstruction itself, right? I've tried to work a little bit more on that. In fact, I think some of the chapters in Black Reconstruction that discuss the ways in which racial terror also served to conscript poor white populations into the elite project of the counter-revolution of property are really important. Du Bois has all these discussions about what he calls the shape of fear in the formation, right, of an inter-class kind of reaction, right, to the possibility of emancipation in the South. Now, the debate around the psychological dimensions or mass psychology or the unconscious even of fascism is very tricky, right? It's a rather bit of a minefield in many ways. The most obvious reason, which I think even most of the partisans of the significance of psychology or psychoanalysis to the study of fascism recognize, is the risk of underestimating the structural and the economical and the geopolitical dimensions of fascism as a process, right? As though it were in some kind of idealistic and strangely individualistic form, the product of bad thoughts and bad dispositions and bad pedagogy or what have you. When the members of the so-called Frankfurt School or the Institute for Social Research in Exile, in the context of the Studies and Prejudice Project, Horkheimer and Adorno and Löwenthal and Guterman and others, turn to this question of what we've come to know as the authoritarian personality. I think the original title of the book was supposed to be The Potential Fascist, which is a little bit punchier. Also constantly correct themselves or present these kind of caveats, right? Like, yes, it's significant to analyze, dissect what the components of this subjectivity may be, but this is only going to be of political note because of phenomena and crises that are happening, you know, at the level of, you know, the social totality and at the level of political economy, right? So I think that's, you know, that's something that's worth always keeping in mind in our discussions. I think there's a lot of rich insights coming from a whole welter of discussions of the psychological, and especially as they try to advance in the final chapter of the book. I think the presence of questions of desire, of gender and sexuality in discussions of fascism, especially of contemporary fascism, can't really be evaded and should be, you know, treated as of primary significance, right? And I think in some sense, I mean, maybe one of the features that I kind of advanced in the book of what I term late fascism is that there does seem to be such an overwhelming presence of these kind of super structural factors in the contemporary far right. Even when, you know, or especially when it enters into the so-called corridors of power, that I think we can't but reflect on the centrality, or if not the centrality, at least the prominence, let's say, of questions of desire and gender and sexuality and psychological and psychoanalytic dispositions more broadly within it, right? Because after all, these are movements or phenomena, or indeed sometimes regimes, which for all of their bluster about, you know, the globalists or about the elites, etc., have, of course, no interest and no intention of transforming social and class relations, except for engaging in racially exclusive or ethno-nationalist policies, right? And therefore are, you know, like many of the fascisms and authoritarianism of the past, are very much prone to this massive emphasis, right, on what we've come to now call, like, you know, culture wars, right? And the one way of thinking about it, to go back to the Du Bois, is that, you know, there's this kind of inverse proportion, right, between their capacity to distribute even to their own, you know, ethno-racially exclusive audiences real wages, and therefore there's a tendency to massively inflate the psychological wages, right, by putting all of the emphasis on, you know, whether it's you know, gender-neutral bathrooms or school curricula or what have you, right, while not just reproducing but intensifying the massive inequalities and the, you know, elite monopoly of social power, etc., right? So I think that's also part of the reason that we cannot but also turn to those debates and to draw on those discussions of the psychological dimensions of fascism and authoritarianism.
Yeah, great, thank you. And that was really helpful for me, actually, the last chapter, talking about kind of the libidinal aspects of fascism, and thinking about how, you know, what we might traditionally conceptualize as a kind of a brute patriarchy as being kind of imminent within fascism, but it's actually, there's so many other ways in which that kind of libidinal energy, I suppose, gets expressed. And yeah. So.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I did want to touch on is, again, we have rather streamlined and at times rather caricatural versions even of what historical fascisms and Nazism's politics of sexuality and gender were. And we have an identification at times of fascism with simple, straightforward sexual or libidinal repression, which of course is not very enlightening when we look at how it operates in the real world, right? And even what patriarchy and misogyny mean today, say in the context of the US right and far right, is by no means, you know, some linear reimposition of bygone or traditional gender norms, right? So I think that's also worth attending to.
We're running slightly close to time, so I just want to draw attention to what I imagine will be kind of a relatively unknown figure in the intellectual history of fascism that you kind of home in on in one of the later chapters, Furio Ghezzi, I don't know if I'm saying his name correctly, who developed this kind of concept of ideas without words. So could you kind of expand on who he was, what he meant by this idea, and how they kind of, this idea kind of operates in, you know, subsuming people into far-right kind of politics?
So Furio Ghezzi was an extremely interesting and unusual intellectual figure in Italy, absurdly precocious scholar and intellectual. I think he was a published Egyptologist and archaeologist in his teens after dropping out of high school because it clearly wasn't stimulating enough for him. And then turning especially to the study of myth and to the study of German literature. And so he published widely in that area. Some of his work has been translated in the context of a series that I edit for the publisher Siegel Books, The Italian List. So first of his books that I translated was called, it's called Spartacus on the Symbology of Revolt on the 1919 revolution, or failed or repressed revolution in Berlin, and the place of myth and literature in that, and then another book called Secret Germany, and another one called Literature and Myth. And you know, he has a very wide set of interests. So in the late 70s, shortly before he died in some freak accident in his home, at a very young age, at 39, I believe, Yeezy published a book called Right Wing Culture, where he tried to apply his knowledge of mythology and his abilities as a literary critic and analyst to the study of the cultural production of the far right, especially when it trespassed into his own scholarly domain, that of myth and mythology. So amongst the figures dealt with is Oswald Spengler, the author of Decline of the West, who is the one from whom Yeezy takes this expression of ideas without words, and also Mircea Eliade and Julius Evola, and so on. And Yeezy tries to map out the place in the culture of the right and of the far right of two dimensions. One is what he calls the religio mortis, or the religion of death, or the centrality of figures and myths of sacrifice in far-right thought and intellectual life. And the other one is this idea of what he calls the language of ideas without words, in a sense, both foregrounding the role of mythology, but also the kind of anti-intellectualism or anti-conceptualism, or we could say to some extent kind of irrationalism of the right, where one both engages in extremely, as in the case of Spengler's near infinite Decline of the West, sort of erudite historical disquisitions, but then at the same time constantly reiterates that the abstract concept cannot know what in some sense the blood or the race or identity or notions that nevertheless are not concepts and that are not open to rational analysis give one insight into, right? So this kind of centrality in certain discourse of the far right of myths of a kind of instinctual intuition, let's say, of the ultimate components of reality, of real truths, etc., that somehow short circuit or deny intellectual analysis and abstraction, right? And so Yeezy works through a lot of these cases in the book. And one of the things that I think is interesting about his emphasis on what he calls the religion of death, and also the way that he reads figures like Eliade or Spengler or Evola, is that I think he also makes us attuned to what we could see as the very significant pessimist and at times nihilist strain, right, within the far right. This sense of almost an obsession with, and at times like a desire for, defeat, right? Mm-hmm. And decline, and this the sense in which the mentality and the kind of psychic life of the far right is not just about, reimposing imagined prior modes of domination or privilege or deference, etc., but also involves a kind of at times rather obscure enjoyment of scenarios of decline or degeneration or sacrifice and so on. And I found that rather an important perspective. And I think that's definitely very true if we think of many of the intellectual origins of the far right in Europe in the early 20th century. was the presence, right, of all of these figures and myths of decline, defeat, sacrifice, and a kind of combination of victimology and suprematism, right? Which, you know, then kind of gets synthesized into, you know, these mythic figures, right? Like white genocide, or, you know, the forgotten man, or et cetera, right? And I think it's important to attend to that, and to see the animus against visions of progress or emancipation, or indeed we could even say against images of happiness, as quite formative to much of the psychic life of the far right.
Yeah, exactly. And Yezzy's work seems really interesting. I'll check it out when I can.
Yeah, do.
So I think we're kind of, coming to time now. So my final question is basically, is there anything else you want to say about the book, or is there anything you want to talk about that you're working on at the moment?
In terms of what I'm working on right now, I suppose I've tried to follow up, as I suggested earlier, on some of the themes of the book that I thought were worth elaborating on further. So since I've finished it, I wrote a couple of other pieces. Again, as I said, one on the place of the kind of psychology of racial terror in Du Bois's Black Reconstruction, and then reading actually that book in a more concerted way as a theory of fascism, even when it doesn't necessarily use the language of fascism so prominently, both in terms of that psychological dimension, but also linking those histories of US racism to the global formation of fascism. And then the other work that I've tried to engage in is really to think more systematically about the analysis of fascism in the 70s in Latin America, because, as I said, I think it really opens up important vistas, and perhaps ones more relevant to our moment, about the nexus between fascism and different moments and modalities of capitalism. And I suppose that's a part of the book that I think, or the part of the question of fascism that I you know, didn't develop probably sufficiently in the book, and that I'd like to maybe deal with more systematically, is the different ways in which questions of political economy and especially of imperialism play within the discussion of and the analysis of fascism, and, you know, hence my mention of Kaletsky and Samuelson, and actually seeing how much these issues were also part of different moments, right? Debates amongst even economists or political economists, right? You know, in order to really, open up and complicate the relationship, let's say, between the libidinal dimensions and then the structural dimensions of this phenomenon, right? Which is a very thorny problem, but I think worth confronting.
Great. Thanks, Alberto.
Hey, thank you very much, Luis.
Thanks very much.